KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm very excited to have on the show James Boyle. James Boyle is a William Neal Reynolds Professor of Law at Duke Law School and co-founder of the Center for the Study of the Public Domain. The public domain is going to be our focus today, and particularly James's new book called, literally, The Public Domain, Enclosing the Commons of the Mind. The public domain is something that we discuss at length on Hearsay Culture. We've talked about it in a variety of contexts, certainly in the copyright context, but also in the information sharing context generally. When we think about issues involving how the internet operates, one of its wonders, and indeed it's almost a cliche now, is how information can be shared. And while information doesn't necessarily want to be free, to paraphrase the famous quote from John Perry Barlow, information certainly can be free and certainly can be shared relatively easily. The public domain allows us at least the possibility of being able to access information without permissions, without licensing, and so forth. The public domain has been one of the major reasons for the development not only of the internet, but more broadly of intellectual prowess and knowledge over millennia. And in Jamie's book, he focuses particularly on the public domain and its values and the threats to it that exist today. And those threats are many. When we think about these issues, we have a variety of moving parts. Of course, we know that intellectual property law, at least in the United States, has a utilitarian theory underlying it, the idea of giving someone economic rewards for the fruits of their labor. At the same time, we also think about copyright as having a durational limit, at least in theory, if not necessarily in practice in 2009. And the idea there, of course, is that we're going to allow the copyright to exist for a certain period of time, and after that, there will be no copyright protection. And it will revert that information, that piece of work, that song, and so forth, into the public domain. What happens, however, if we don't have a public domain? What happens if the public domain is curtailed to the point that we cannot benefit from knowledge, music, and so forth without asking for permission, without paying a licensing fee? And in Jamie's book, he runs through the impacts. He runs through the benefits of the public domain as well as its threats. As I was reading Jamie's book, I came across a particular passage which I think is useful to set the stage of where we're headed and indeed where we are in 2009. In the book, in the chapter entitled The Internet Threat, James talks about competition and how competition operates in the context of the famous Sony case involving VCRs and the Betamax recording system. He writes, in certain situations, though, competition will not work. If the dinosaurs are a cartel strong enough to squelch competition, if they have enlisted the state to make threatening technology illegal, describing it as a predatory encroachment on the rights, quote-unquote, of the old guard rather than aggressive competition, if ingrained prejudices are simply so strong that the potential business benefits take years to become apparent, or if the market has, quote, locked in, unquote, on a dominant standard, a technology or an operating system, say, to which new market entrants do not have legal access. In those situations, markets cannot be counted on to self-correct. Unfortunately, and this is a key point, intellectual property policy frequently deals with controversies in which all of these conditions hold true. James goes on to say, and this is how we can start off our discussion. Let me repeat this point, because it is one of the most important ones in the book. To a political scientist or market analyst, the conditions I have just described sound like a rarely seen perfect storm of legislative and market dysfunction. To an intellectual property scholar, they sound like business as usual. James, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you for having me.
James, let's start right off with a question that I always ask authors on the show. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about more about your background and how you got interested in these issues.
Well, I came to the United States from Scotland and went to Harvard, where I studied, focusing mainly on legal theory. And as I worked on legal theoretical issues, particularly involving issues of interpretation, I got more and more interested in the role that authors have in every aspect. Authors as as the figures who control the meaning of their works. So does the Constitution depend on the intent of the framers, or does the meaning of Hemingway's novel depend on what he meant by it? Authors as rights owners, people who control the rights to their works. Authors as cultural icons. What do we think of when we think of an author? Is the author just a scribe who is transcribing the inspiration that comes straight from the Godhead? Is the author a craftsman? Is the author an embodiment of universal genius? And I started to see all of those issues as being linked, and the place in which they're most obviously linked is actually in the area of intellectual property and informational control in general. And so starting in the early 1990s, which turned out to be a rather good time to first start focusing on these issues, I turned to that area and got more and more involved in it and have been working in it pretty much ever since.
You're joining us from your office at Duke University, which of course is one of the leading educational institutions in the United States. How has the public domain or the availability of works in the public domain helped you as a scholar as well as a teacher?
Well, I think it's one of these things where it's so ubiquitous that it's almost hard to understand it. It's almost like we're at the stage that people were at in trying to understand oxygen before they were even fully aware of the atmosphere as that which surrounded and sustained us. I mean, the public domain is all around us. Obviously, when you and I speak, we use a language, whether it's English or French or whatever, which requires no license to speak, nor license to innovate. You're allowed to create new words. Now, in other forms of language, let's say the Low French, for example, the scribal languages of thousands of years ago, that was not necessarily the case. It may have been a closed language. People might not have had access to it. Or it might be a language, and this was true, and in some languages, in the Académie Française in France, would like it still to be true. It might be a language where you said, well, you can't innovate, you can't make up new words, you can't change the language or bring in new hybrids and so forth. It's actually a closed system, a system that is controlled, even if not by property rights. That's just one example. We take it for granted that there aren't problems of incompatibility. I'm running English 1.0, you're running English 2.0, mm-hmm. That there aren't issues of licensing, that there aren't issues of access. And indeed, all of our culture is built on this idea of a language held in common, which we all have access to, which we all can take, use, remix, rework, and create new things from, even if those things are ultimately, let's say, poems or novels, covered by intellectual property rights. And that, far from being something strange or something exceptional, is actually the norm. The public domain is actually the most common source of new culture, of new science. It is the raw material which everyone, not just scholars, uses to make and remake the world around us. In a video that we did for Creative Commons, which was actually filmed by Jesse Dillon, Bob Dillon's son, very distinguished documentary filmmaker, one of the opening lines is from Hal Abelson, a former colleague on the Creative Commons board, and Hal says very simply, "What does it mean to be human if you don't have a shared culture? And what's a shared culture if you can't share it?" He put it more eloquently and more tersely, as always, than I did, but I think that's the basic point.
And Hal was actually on the show not too long ago discussing the book that he co-authored, Blown to Bits, and we enjoy talking to him here on the show. When we think about these issues, Jamie, it was interesting to me as I read through your book, and I met you when I was a fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford a few years ago, and it was interesting to me to see your focus on the internet and the internet's impact on the public domain. But one of the things you said that you wrote in the book struck me, and I think it's worth discussing. You wrote that, and this is a quote, "I care about the web not because I want to live my life there, but because of what it has allowed me to achieve, what it represents for the potential of open science and culture. Now, that's an interesting perspective, and it's not one that we perhaps stereotypically expect to hear from people who are so interested in both from a scholarly perspective and from a speaking perspective as well in the internet. And I'm curious to just get perhaps delve that a little bit more. How does that perspective inform your work? Because we tend to think of, at least stereotypically think of people that are involved in technology as wanting to spend their lives with it.
No, that for me that would be purgatory. I'm not the idea of, as I said in the book, the idea of having an avatar in a virtual world, or of building up points on World of Warcraft, or of obsessively dealing with Facebook, etc., is utterly anathema to me. That's not the kind of life that I want to live. And in fact, I think in many ways the people who are critics of the way in which human interaction can be impoverished by substituting, always substituting the virtual for the immediate, I think they have a point, even if it's one that's taken to sort of bah humbug sort of extremes. My point here was that, and it relates to the very first quote that you read, the thing that fascinates me about the internet is not the idea that I could spend my life wrapped in a warm Web 2.0 cocoon with my cell phone constantly broadcasting my geolocation and my seldom used Twitter feed advertising everything that I cook or buy or every sniffle that I have. Rather, the internet interests me because it's a black swan. The black swan is used in philosophy as the example of the thing which simply falsifies the prior proposition, all swans are white. No, there's a black swan. The internet is this wonderfully glaring example of some of our most common assumptions about the need for control, the need for things to be closed, the need for property rights, the need for hierarchy, the need for certain forms of social organization, that all of those prejudices, prejudgments, can be false. Not that they're always false, but that they can be false. And the question is, do we take this black swan, this glaring counterexample to our normal assumptions, our everyday assumptions about the way the property works and control works and hierarchy works and organizations work, and do we sort of marginalize it, push it off into some tiny little, oh, well, of course, there's the internet where things aren't quite like that, but then everything else runs that way. Or do we take it seriously? Do we look at it and say, wow, why are our intuitions here so wrong? Why do things play out more differently than we would ever have imagined if I said to you, as I say in the book, and if I say to you in 1990, create the world's largest encyclopedia, come up with a business plan. Would your business plan have been, we'll have like a web page and we'll like put stuff up and then people can like add to it?
Right.
No one would have said that. So why were we so wrong, number one, and this is the key part, where else might we be wrong? In other words, let's take the internet seriously, not as the internet, but as a way of thinking about everything else in our lives and questioning whether our perceptions in those other areas are also incorrect.
We're talking with James Boyle, the author of the book The Public Domain, Enclosing the Commons of the Mind, which James, interestingly, also allows for download on publicdomain.org, which is something we'll talk about shortly.
I just said, David, yes. Thepublicdomain.org.
Oh, excuse me, the public, yes.
I have no idea what's at publicdomain.org, but in case it's a porn site, I just said what.
Fair enough. That's probably pretty, and if it's publicdomain.org, that's a pretty large site, so assuming that it isn't pornography. Yeah. Fair enough. Thank you for that correction. To follow up on that point you just made, James, I'm curious at your perspective. I mean, you've been and you were one of the early thinkers in thinking about the internet as a tool of the public domain, a tool of information sharing, and your work there is well known. As you scan your field in 2009, people that are thinking about technology in these ways, do you think they share your view of the internet, your view of technology, the ways that you interact with it, or do you think that there's more of a, and you hear these criticisms of kind of a euphoric, utopian attitude towards technology as being the end-all, be-all, and something that can solve all of the world's ills?
I think there's just an enormously wide range. I think if you look at the people who, both in scholarly terms and non-scholarly terms, have been involved with this, one of the things that makes the field I work in so fascinating is that if I ask you your views about intellectual property in the public domain and the way that networks work and should work, I can predict nothing significant about your political views in any other field. Mm. If I ask your view on the legalization of marijuana or of whether or not abortion, the right to have an abortion should be a constitutional right, or the correct interpretation of the Second Amendment or what have you, I can, with reasonable accuracy, if I have you give me three data points like that, I can guess with some degree of accuracy what many of your other political beliefs are likely to be. Hopefully you'll be more interesting than the stereotypes, but as we know from political science research, the patterns are relatively solid. What's fascinating about this field is that there are wide ranges of attitudes, not just about technology, which your question goes to, but about politics. So that if you go to, you know, the Cato Institute, Libertarian Cato Institute, some people associated with the Cato Institute look at intellectual property, say it's property, property is good, we want more property, the more property the better, we know all the virtues of property, property helps markets. Other people look at it and go, oh my goodness, this is a classic example of a governmentally created monopoly. It's an interference with competition. It's what we always said, which was that the state would be corrupted and taken over by groups which would get it to insulate them from competition, hand out enormous monopoly rents. It's everything that we as libertarians have always been against. And on technology, you get the same thing. Some people look at the technology of the net and say, don't worry, you don't need to do anything about this. The technology inherently carries with it the DNA of freedom. It's always evolving in the direction of greater freedom. The arc of technology is long but bends towards openness. And others are saying, nonsense, this is happenstance. You know, we happened to get the net that we got because of a series of extremely factitious and random events. It could have gone another way. It could have been closed. It could have been controlled. And it still could be. We could change back. We could change the nature of the personal computer. We could change the nature of the network. And those things could happen. And so you really have a wide range of views on both technology and politics. And that's actually what makes the field so interesting to work in, is that the positions aren't yet stereotyped.
Mm-hmm. The defining characteristic of the book, indeed the title, is the public domain. And I think it's useful to start at almost the first basic question. How do you define the public domain? Is it merely the absence of rights, the ability to do something without permission? What's your definition of it?
I think the working definition is the material, the intellectual material that you're able to use without permission or fee, whether that's E equals MC squared, whether that's the works of Shakespeare, whether that's Bach, whether or not that's, you know, basic language or thought. I think for those who are interested, so I think that's a good enough definition. I'm a pragmatist in many ways, philosophically speaking, and so definitions are tools, not ends in themselves. A definition a legal realist once said is an insurance policy, and like no insurance policy can insure against all risks. Mm-hmm. So if you want a more precise definition than that, so for example, in the United States, there's a provision called Fair Use, Section 107 of the Copyright Act, which is what allows you to quote from my book if you wanted to without permission, which allows you to parody, which allows you to make some amount of photocopies for classroom use and so forth. Should we see that as part of the public domain, those particular uses, or should we say, well, no, that's an exception which only happens in certain circumstances and for certain contexts? I don't think there's a single right answer to that. I think it depends on what intellectual project one is engaged in. As a practical matter, I think it's useful to think about our intellectual ecology, not just in terms of complete works that are completely free, all of the works of Shakespeare, E equals MC squared and so forth, but rather also to think about the limitations and exceptions within the rights themselves. So instead of a sort of picture of, a world, a map divided into two countries, opposing countries, one the realm of the public domain, which might be, I don't know, blue, and the realm of the property, which might be red, we should instead see a map that is much more complicated, in which private rights of way constantly, private property rather, is threaded through with public rights of way. Under certain circumstances, you can walk through my land to get to the beach, and that's part of the limitation that the state imposes on my property rights, part of your entitlement as a citizen. I think that for many purposes, that's a better definition if one's getting into the interstices of intellectual property. But for most purposes, stuff that you can use without permission or fee, I think, gets you most of the way there.
Your subtitle, Enclosing the Commons of the Mind, of course, conjures up an earlier age. Those terms, enclosing and the commons, of course, are terms that come from traditional property law. So perhaps I'll ask you a similar question. What do you mean by the subtitle?
Well, I think I'm not the only one who's thought this, but I think there's a profound analogy today to what we're doing to intellectual space, to what we did to physical space, to arable land, in fact, in the enclosure movement, which in fact was a series of movements across Europe, particularly in Britain, where commonly held pasturage or waste or the common field were turned into private property. And the argument in the case of agricultural land was that this was actually necessary for development, that we were never going to go invest in building walls and improving land with dams, that we were never going to fertilize, that we were either going to overgraze the land or underuse the land or overfish the pond or destroy it. And what we needed to do was get stuff out of the commons and back into private property where it would be used efficiently by a single owner. And that's our sort of default thinking about property in market societies. And has a lot of truth to it. There are a lot of interesting exceptions, and some interesting contemporary work by economists has pointed out a lot of limitations, even in the context of land and of tangible property. But nevertheless, the basic point is a powerful one. My point in talking about that is to say, even if that argument holds true for physical property or for land, it really has many limitations and exceptions and needs to be thought about much more carefully in the case of intellectual property. It's really hard to overgraze an idea. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to deplete in the way that we worry about with environmental resources a song. There may be problems of incentives in generating these resources. There may be issues of custodianship. But we can't simply apply our logic of property from tangible or real property and just transpose it point for point onto intellectual property. It turns out that there are lots of possibilities, not of tragedies of the commons, but of comedies of the commons, to use Carol Rose's phrase, of commonses that actually work better than private property, that cut down on transaction costs, that allow for greater innovation. And that's one of the areas where I think intellectual property is drawn on the internet as an example, but has drawn on lots of other things, ranging from scientific research to the way that jazz is developed, to, as I said, the kind of joyful chaos that is the English language. Realize in these areas, it's not at all clear that a commons isn't the best solution.
We are going to be chatting later on in this quarter with Michael Heller from Columbia Law School, as you know, wrote the book The Gridlock Economy, where he talks about he does talk about the opposite of the tragedy of the commons. What he talks about is a tragedy of the anti-commons and the idea of underuse of a resource because of all the permissions that are necessary. How does the public domain as a construct address those issues of underuse?
Well, I think it addresses it very simply. I mean, there's a basic problem with informational resources that economists identify. Kenneth Arrow identified it as an informational paradox, which is it's very hard to value information and information assets if you don't have them. So here, Dave, I have some information. I will need to sell it to you. What is it? Well, I can't tell you. All right? That's very hard. But then if I tell you, well, now you know. So what value are you going to put on it then? And that's a situation that is really somewhat difficult. I can take back the apple without you eating it. I can take back the plate of the steak if you're not going to pay it for me. But the information is rather hard to dispossess you of. What the public so that point, I think, is a basic one. And the public domain solves that very simply by saying, here's all of this stuff. Anyone can use it. But there's a second point, which is often you look at something and you think, well, I don't know, could I use this, could I not use this? But faced with the transaction cost, of the need to ask for permissions, which is Professor Heller's point, goes to the places where lots and lots of people can say no, but there's no one single person who can say yes, and that's one of the essences of an anti-commons. Mm-hmm. Also, the fees. There's another thing, I think, about information, which as believers in sort of liberalism with a small L, the idea of classical liberalism, informational assets, most of which, thank goodness, are in the public domain, make us who we are. My guess is that most of your listeners spent much of their time in school reading books that they weren't supposed to be reading. They're sent to read one book in the library, they read the next one. They read something else. They're probably people who've been fascinated all their lives by things beyond their current course of study. And one of the reasons why they've done that is that they've existed in an informational environment inside universities, in libraries, in our common culture, where there's a lot of free access, browsing access permitted, where you don't have to have this sort of micropayment, pay as you go for every informational asset. And the thing about that is that shaped them to be the people that they are today, and the result of that is that their preferences are different. And the public domain, for me, one of the most important things about it is that unless there's a very strong argument for locking things up, we should leave things free so that all of us can become the people that we want to be, can develop without all of these barriers in front of us. That doesn't mean that there should be no patents on drugs. That doesn't mean there should be no copyrights on books. I'm actually a great believer in intellectual property rights. But it does mean that the burden of proof is on the people who want to expand those rights.
We're talking with Professor James Boyle of Duke University School of Law, author of the book The Public Domain, Enclosing the Commons of the Mind on KZSU-FM Stanford's Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. First, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. And either way, you will get a prompt response from our underwriting department. In these lean times, I know asking for money may seem like a difficult thing, but I do hope that you consider making a donation to KZSU. It does go to benefit Hearsay Culture as well as the diverse programming that exists at KZSU, so I hope that you will consider it. James, let's talk a little bit perhaps about an example of what you mean by enclosing the commons of the mind. You trace a very long history of thought with regard to the public domain, and I want to get into that in a moment, particularly your discussion of Thomas Jefferson's writings, and Macaulay's writings, which I think are very enlightening, and many listeners may not be familiar with. But perhaps I can ask you for this modern day example: is there a paradigmatic modern day example of the enclosing of the commons of the mind that causes you concern?
Absolutely. There are a number, depending whether your listeners are more interested in science or in culture or in music, I could give examples in each, but I think
we can focus on technology, perhaps.
Right. Yeah. Well, let me give one that actually catches on technology, but also goes to the issue of culture, which is one of the chapters of the book where I describe the way that the history of a single song, a protest song, was developed after the government's response to Hurricane Katrina, and two rappers who were volunteering in the Houston Astrodome, who were members of a band called the Legendary KO, wrote a rap song which was basically sampled from a song by Kanye West, who had famously declared that he didn't think that George Bush was sympathetic to African Americans during a fundraising drive for the victims of Hurricane Katrina. And they took his song, they took West's song, and they changed the words and made a song which was downloaded by millions and turned into a video and then watched by even more millions. And it was a very immediate, very quick, almost costless response to a human tragedy where citizens were able to speak out. Whether or not you agree with their message, I think it was something which those of you who believe in free speech would find quite quite inspiring. And when I traced the history of that song and then West's song and then the songs that West took from Ray Charles, who he sampled, and then the songs that Ray Charles drew on. Back in history, one of the things that I noticed was that if you took this 100-year-long history of musical borrowing, that the law had only really got into the business of regulating very small-scale musical borrowing, either practically or legally speaking, in the last 20 or so years. It wasn't that there wasn't music copyright, there was. But the idea that small-level appropriation would be regulated was a relatively recent one, and indeed the practices that people like Ray Charles or the founders of jazz or of the blues engaged in, if analyzed under hornbook music copyright law, are almost certainly illegal. Hmm. And just think about that for a second. Now, your listeners may not be lovers of rap music, or they may, but think of a world in which the rules of the game in terms of copyright meant that the kind of free and easy borrowing that happens in jazz all the time, we don't say get a license or do not solo, you may not quote from the chords of I Got Rhythm by George Gershwin or this fragment of Happy Birthday as you're right doing your sax solo. Imagine that each case you did that, you had to license each note or set of notes. And you literally would destroy the art form that is jazz, because jazz is built on mutual reference. There's an example of how we have moved the goalposts, moved the line between the realm of property and the realm of the public domain, and we've made more stuff covered by property. And the point is that if you look back in history, it is fairly clear that had we had those rules in the 1930s or the 1920s, we wouldn't have the musical tradition that we have today. What are we giving up today by not having these rules? That's an example. That's the counterfactual, which your opening quote about technology and the Betamax brings out. In that case, we didn't ban the VCR, and we know what happened. But what about the situations where we change the rules and we say, well, we will increase intellectual property rights? Are we foreclosing new cultural forms, new kinds of science? And I think that's the stake of the battles that it's involved, and it's a nice concrete example.
Do you think policymakers, use a loose phrase, get it? Do you think, as you talk about these issues and as you discuss your views on these issues, and like I said in the introduction, this is not your first book in this area. You've been talking about these issues for quite a while. Do you think policymakers get it? The idea of foreclosing something which doesn't exist can be viewed as an abstract point. What do you sense from the policymaking side?
I think that the progress has been slow. But there's been definite progress made. When I wrote my first book on these issues in the mid-90s, it was almost impossible to get people to understand what I was talking about, the idea that the New York Times or the Washington Post would care about. They didn't know what the public domain was, let alone why they would care about it. He kept saying, why don't you write about free speech? I was like, this is a free speech issue. It's like, no, well, there's no porn in it. So I think there's definitely been a change. You can say to someone, you know Wikipedia? And they're like, yeah. It's like, so think about that. They're like, oh, I kind of get it. People taking stuff because it's not owned and creating something else. And, oh, yeah, that's kind of interesting. Example. So there are more examples. I think there are more policymakers who get it. I think, for example, the debates over things like net neutrality have enlightened few. But I still think that the standard sort of default response of most policymakers is property is good, more property is better. Intellectual property rights give innovation, so that means even more intellectual property rights will give more innovation, and the higher the level of rights, the greater the incentive, and the greater the incentive, the greater the innovation. And then if you say, and where's the raw material that these people are going to build these innovations out of? Are they going to be licensing every little tiny fragment of the code or the gene sequences or the musical notes that they're using? Are they actually going to be create at all? Can't we actually destroy creativity by having rights that are too strong as well as rights that are too weak? They're like, oh, I don't know. I never really looked at it that way. So I think there's still a lot of progress to be made.
We are talking with Jamie Boyle, author of the book The Public Domain and Closing the Commons of the Mind on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. Jamie, let's talk about this also, and I think what your answer just now leads us to actually take a step back in time. As I mentioned that in the introduction and earlier, you trace the history of this thought and you talk about Thomas Jefferson's work. It seems like some of what you were just saying is in fact what you refer to as the Jefferson Warning in the book. What is the Jefferson Warning?
Well, the Jefferson Warning, I was sort of punning on the Miranda Warning. You know, if the police are going to arrest you, they have to read you your rights. And the rights are a caution. Like here, you're entering this space where you're advised that you may want to get a lawyer, and you're advised that, you know, the stuff you say may have legal consequences. And basically mining the works of Jefferson, I said that there were a number of instructive ideas that people might take from the works of Jefferson. The first simple point is that physical property and intellectual property have incredibly important differences. We can't simply transpose our assumptions about one to our assumptions about the other. Jefferson talks about ideas being expansible across all space like fire. He who lights his taper at mine is illuminated, and I am not thereby darkened. And he looks at this not as a tragedy, but as a potential comedy, as a potential good thing. Jefferson also says, though, that rights may be necessary. He's very clear about this. The rights may be necessary in order to encourage innovation and incentives. But if they are, even if we say, yes, we do need intellectual property rights, drug patents may help provide the necessary incentive to get people to invest the millions of dollars necessary to bring a new pharmaceutical to market, we still have to be incredibly careful. Even if we've decided, okay, we're going to have intellectual property rights, we then have to think about the limits of those rights. It's not the end of the story. You don't just say, okay, we'll have rights, and now let's make them as strong as possible. Instead, we look at the rights, and we say, what are the ways in which we circumscribe this right so that we don't have the deadweight effects of monopoly, or we have the most limited negative forms of those effects? So limitations of duration, how long should the right last? Limitations of scope, what does it cover? Am I giving you a patent over the corkscrew or of the idea of opening wine, or indeed the idea of opening beverages in general, or indeed the idea of opening? Where does the right stop? What about competition? What about follow-on innovation? These are all things that we have to think about when we design our system. And so one of the things I've tried to do in the book, and when I talk to people from outside this field, they look at me and think, wow, this guy really is kind of boring if this is all he can manage to come up with, is that we should actually make this policy the way we make policy in other fields, with evidence based on something other than intuition, and not just based on a series of implicit faith-based precepts like the more rights we have, the more innovations. Like, let's go and look. You know, Europe has a database directive. We don't. What happened to the two database industry? We could study that at the end of the day. Should we have a database directive? No, and neither should Europe. the facts are there, and they're relatively clear. So the Jefferson Warning tells us to be modest in the scope of our rights. We may need rights. Not to think about them the way that we think about physical property rights, to circumscribe them, that the burden of proof is on the person putting them forward, and that we actually need evidence and not just faith when we are making policy.
One of the challenges, I think, of people that speak about a public domain, and you referred to this earlier, but I think it should be amplified, is the assumption is, well, you're in favor of a public domain, therefore you're against intellectual property rights. And I think that's an unwarranted criticism, but it's a criticism that we hear often. How do you balance those two? I mean, that's a question. Obviously, it could take hours and weeks and years to say how we balance intellectual property rights, but perhaps from a broader perspective, how do you explain the public domain, the need for the public domain, in the context of being a supporter of intellectual property in terms of the need for rights and the right of authors to be able to get pecuniary gain from their works?
Well, I think that the answer is that it's actually a subtle and difficult process. I'm delighted, I have to say, in this debate that there are now many people who are much more strident in their denunciations of intellectual property. I argue in the book that the basics of the system are good, and actually copyright and patent have a valuable role to play. And so instead, you have people like Baldwin and Levine have a book called Against Intellectual Monopoly, which says basically takes even the strongest cases most people think for intellectual like drug patents and say they don't even think there that they're a good idea. So I'm delighted that I'm now finally being seen for the boring centrist that I am, and despite the occasional efforts of the recording industry, the movie industry, to paint people like me as extremists. I view us as kind of the last defenders of intellectual property because we're actually defending the good sense at the heart of the system rather than the awful, bloated, sort of steroid-encrusted version of it that they would like to promote. And in the end of the day, I actually think that will be good for them because it won't upset their audience.
You also discuss in the book the writings of Macaulay, and although there's a heavy U.S. Listenership to Hearsay Culture, there's an international listenership as well, but I think fewer people stateside may be familiar with Macaulay. One of the quotes that you take from Macaulay's writings that I think also is resonates today is a quote where Macaulay wrote that monopoly makes articles scarce to make them dear and to make them bad. Why is that view, that particular view of monopoly power, important today?
I think it's a view that is widely accepted in every other context than intellectual property. So if you ask most people what monopolies do, they would agree with Levine, they would agree with Macaulay that the general tendency of monopoly is to make things dear, scarce, and bad. Intellectual property rights are a complicated issue. This is really hard. You shouldn't call them monopolies. I mean, I may have a monopoly over my song or my novel, but if nobody wants to play it or listen to it or buy it, then that's hardly a monopoly. A monopoly is a position of advantage in the market, not just a legal guarantee. And there's truth to that, I think. But the response is that when the state says, we are basically saying that the normal process of competition, which is that people imitate what others are doing in the market and try and bring down costs, in this particular area with regard to this thing, this drug, this business method patent, this line of software code or whatever, that people can't copy there, then they really are having a state-created monopoly over that particular item. And I think that one of the things that is fascinating, at least I think it's fascinating, is that in the last 20 years where we've really had this kind of market triumphalism, people saying markets are brilliant, they may work well, maybe we've fallen away from that a little bit in the last year and a half, but this idea that markets are great and states are dumb and that government regulators are just idiots, just bumbling incompetents who screw up everything they touch. The one place where we had this amazing faith in government regulators is when they were designing these new intellectual property rights for some of our most important industries. At this moment, the bumbling incompetence disappeared and were replaced by laser-armed geniuses with scalpels who could carve the perfect monopoly right for our software industries and our gene sequencing industries. And I'm sorry, it's like, you can have one. You can have your incompetent regulators and policymakers, or you can have your brilliant ones, but you can't have both at the same time. And that's why I think Macaulay's point is very important today.
We're talking to Professor James Boyle, author of the book The Public Domain, Enclosing the Commons in a Mind on Hearsay Culture on KZSU FM Stanford. The book is available at thepublicdomain.org. James, we have about 10 or so minutes left, and of course we can only touch the tip of the iceberg in the time that we have, but I think it's also important to talk about what you coined the internet threat. And so without further ado, what is the internet threat in the context of enclosing the public domain?
Well, the idea of the internet threat is a powerful idea which has a lot of truth to it, but ultimately will lead us in the wrong direction. And the powerful idea is this. Imagine a timeline, on which you trace the costs of copying something. So at one end you have a monk in a scriptorium laboriously tracing out Aristotle's Poetics. And then a little further on, you know, in the 1400s, 1500s, you have the development of the printing press. And then the further on, you have faster printing presses, you have radio, you have movies, you have cyclostyle mimeograph photocopying machines, VCRs, and then the development of the World Wide Web. And at the other end of this timeline, copying costs going from being incredibly high, you know, one monk, 3 months, to being, oh, sure, I'll download that. It's only 16 megs. Yeah, here it is. It's on, I've got it right here. You can download it, too. In fact, you can be downloading it while I am as well. At that point, copying costs are almost zero. And the idea, the storyline behind the Internet Thread is that the intellectual property rights should vary inversely with the costs of copying. So when you've got your monk and your scriptorium, you don't need copyright because, you know, you just need to get your own monk, you know. There's no need to worry about multiple cheap copies circulating because copies are expensive. We get Gutenberg. We actually don't get copyright for about another 200 or so years, but Gutenberg, now we have the possibility of mass-producing, costs of copying are falling, and this is where we start to think about the need for exclusivity, and as the costs continue to fall, goes the argument behind the Internet Thread, the rights need to continue to get higher, so at the point on the graph where costs go to zero of copying, the rights should basically be almost infinitely strong. There should be total physical as well as legal control of what you do with your music or your movies or your books. So that the as Pamela Samuelson of Berkeley says, the texts will rat on you if you try and use them in unapproved ways. Your computer will refuse to do what you're saying. We need perfect control to deal with a world of cheap copying. That's the idea behind the Internet Threat. The Internet is a threat. And there's truth to it. Cheaper copying does bring threats to some of these business models and may indeed require state intervention. But, of course, the problem with it is completely one-sided. It only sees the threat. It doesn't see the benefits the Internet brings, including the benefit to content providers, who now have dramatically decreased costs of distribution, of reproduction, of advertising, often of production itself. This isn't just a deadweight loss here. It's a benefit as well. And what I argue for in the book is that we've seen this. We have this 2020 downside vision. We see only the threats and not the benefits, and you started this program with a quote about the VCR.
Right.
Jack Valenti famously said about the VCR that the VCR was to the movie industry as the Boston Strangler is to the woman alone. 5 years after he said that, and after the movie industry had lost its Supreme Court case, trying to have it ruled that the manufacturer of the VCR, in this case the videotape recorder, was guilty of contributory copyright infringement. So VCRs are legal and cheap. 5 years after Valenti said that, video rentals were providing 50% of Hollywood's revenues. They had seen the threats. People will copy tapes of movies! And they had completely neglected the benefits. And they lost, and thank goodness for them they did. Because the result was a technology which continued to sustain them for about the next 15 or 20 years. My point about the Internet Threat is, if we continue to regulate under the delusion of the Internet Threat alone, not seeing the benefits, focusing only on the costs, we'll never know about those stories of the VTR, VCR, because we will legislate it out of existence or change its technology or regulate it so thoroughly that the pluses will never become known. And that's the question of what is it that we are foregoing without even knowing that we are foregoing it by this current insane rush to extend patent rights and copyrights and to increase regulation and never to think about the plus side of the Internet.
We're talking with James Boyle, a professor and author of the book The Public Domain and Closing the Commons of the Mind. So, James, you have come full circle, and that was my intention as well. When you talk about, and as I quoted, you talk about the business-as-usual world for an intellectual property scholar being one that to other economists would look like a perfect storm of dysfunction across the board. The logical question is, okay, James, I hear the problem. I agree that it's a problem. But I'm just an average consumer of content. What can I do about this? Do you have any suggestions? What can a listener who's concerned about this issue, concerned about policymakers being able to see, further ahead, than perhaps many currently do? What do you suggest that people do?
Well, the analogy I use in the book is the analogy of the environmental movement. I think it's an analogy on every level. If you had told us, you know, 50 years ago that people could understand ideas of, you know, externalities caused by pollution, that they could understand this idea of the complex web of the ecosystem, that this could become an issue of public debate, that it could change private behavior, the, you know, put a brick in your toilet and buy a Prius, people would have said, this is crazy. You know, people aren't thinking about that stuff. That stuff's not important to them. But, of course, that stuff became important to them. You had intellectuals working on it. You had activists. You had people telling stories. And it intruded into people's lives. They started to see things as connected. Oh, yeah, the smog that I see is connected to the story about this burning canal and to the story about birth defects. And, you know, this stuff is all part of a larger framework. I think that little by little, the same thing is happening in the world of copyright and patent and of trademark. People are beginning to see issues that had seemed isolated. Why can't I watch that movie in the Library of Congress? Nobody is interested in exploiting it. It's not commercially available. Wait, you're telling me somebody owns a business method for adding up the prices of mutual funds? That mm-hmm. can't be right, can it? Wait, this stuff's still copyrighted? Wait, there's patents on this gene sequence? Those things seem separate. They seem like they're isolated, but they're not. And what we need is an intellectual, but also a practical, everyday movement that puts them together.
Perhaps this is a good time to ask you about the Center for the Study of the Public Domain. What is your center, and how does it attempt to affect some of these issues?
Well, the center works on sort of translating these kinds of ideas into various other arenas. So when I got here, David Lang, who wrote one of the great early articles on the public domain, has always been an inspiration to my work. And looking at it, I thought, well, there are all these great, you know, centers of intellectual property around the world, but there's no center on the public domain. It's sort of like if you had thousands of centers on industrial development and not a single center on the environment. You know, surely you need to think about both if you want to make good policy. And so the job of our center is to tell the story from the other side of the balance, and it is a balance, and to try and translate academic research for policymakers, but also for creators. So, for example, we have a comic book, which is freely available online, which explains the law of fair use. It's called Bound by Law. It explains the law of fair use to artists, creators, to filmmakers, who for some reason don't want to read our law review articles. You know, go figure. I can't understand it, but this makes it a little bit more accessible. We're writing a new one on the history of music, the history of musical borrowing over the last 2,000 years. And we also do, you know, scholarly reports on international development and public goods, on science, synthetic biology. We really scan across the gamut of issues in which this boundary line between intellectual property and the public domain exists, which really is pretty much everywhere in science and culture. And we try and take the best of the knowledge from academia, develop it further, have the highest level minds working on it, but then try and turn it around so to make it accessible to policymakers, to citizens, to creators. And that's really the mission of our center at its best.
Are you optimistic, James, that the public domain or the second enclosure movement, as you refer to it, can be reversed?
I have dark moments and lighter moments, but I think it can at least, we can stop the process of decline. I think the next attempt to extend copyright will have a lot harder row to hoe than the Sonny Bono Term Extension Act in 1998. I think that in some areas we can reverse things. I think it is quite likely that the new patent office will be run rather better than it has been in the past. I think it's quite likely that the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit has seen the error of some of its ways, that we're likely to get different decisions about business method patents. That we're actually beginning to understand the dangers of introducing intellectual property rights into foundational technologies and things like synthetic biology. I think there are great workarounds. Creative Commons, which I was very honored to chair for a while, I think is an amazing workaround. The Public Library of Science, open access to scientific journals. There are ways that people have managed to work around the dangers of enclosing the public domain. So I'm optimistic about all of those. You know, and then I see that, you know, Representative Conyers has introduced a bill which would forbid the federal government from ever saying that, hey, when I give you a grant at the end of the day, a year after you publish, I expect the general public and the rest of the scientists in the world to be able to actually read the research that they paid for. They go, we should forbid that. I was like, wait, we should forbid it? Not require it? We should forbid it? And at moments like that, I get deeply depressed.
The book is The Public Domain, Enclosing the Commons of the Mind. The author is Professor James Boyle from Duke University School of Law. James, for people that want to learn more about your work, we've mentioned the publicdomain.org where the book can be downloaded. Do you have any other suggestions where they can go?
Yeah, have a look at the publicdomain.org, or you can just come to Duke Law School webpage, and the Center for the Study of the Public Domain has all kinds of cool video and comic books and scholarly reports, and of course, given our mission, it all has to be freely available.
James, thank you so much for joining us in Hearsay Culture. And as always, certainly I invite you back on the show to continue the discussion. So I look forward to further discussions. But thank
you. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you kindly. I'm very excited to discuss a number of upcoming guests on Hearsay Culture, including Kevin Bankston from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We'll be on discussing EFF's litigation involving warrantless wiretapping. Professor John Turanian from Chapman University School of Law will be on discussing his book, Whitewashed. As I mentioned earlier, Professor Michael Heller from Columbia University School of Law will be on discussing his book, The Gridlock Economy. Siva Vaidya Nathan of the University of Virginia will be on discussing his book, The Google is of Everything. Kazis Varnelis and Geert Lovink, European scholars in technology, will be on as well later in the fall. Professor Alex Halavay from Quinnipiac University School of Law discussing his book Search Engine Society. Professor Gordon Hull from University of North Carolina Charlotte will be on discussing ethics in technology, as well as Professor Wendy Chun will be on the show discussing her work on race identity in technology. Professor Frank Pasquale and Professor Danielle Citron will be on discussing their work involving fusion centers, one of particular interest to me. Professor Tarleton Gillespie from Cornell University will be on discussing his book involving copyright and the creation of content. Annalie Newitz will be on discussing her many writings involving technology over the last several years. Repeat guests, Professor Bobby Quall from DePaul University will be on probably next year discussing her book involving, again, copyright and moral rights of authors. And Professor Jackie Lipton from Case Western Reserve University School of Law, my alma mater, will be on discussing her views of copyright, as well as Laura DeNardis from Yale's Information Society Project, who will be discussing her work involving government and intellectual property and the operations of government generally. As always, you can listen to the show a variety of ways. You can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can pick up all of the current shows, all of the previous shows, as well as see occasional blogging. You can listen to the show, of course, on KZSU-FM Stanford on Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also get the show through the Center for Internet Society's iTunes podcast page by searching Stanford Center for Internet Society. And last but not least, of course, you can go to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I also welcome your feedback, comments, suggestions by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. And otherwise, I thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoyed it. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.